you're listening to 1001 Album Club, where each episode we discuss a different album from Robert Emery's book, 1001 Albums Was Here Before You Die. This episode, we're doing Nirvana, Nevermind. In the room, I have Anne.
Hey.
And Rob.
Crank the volume. Ears are bleeding.
And on the line, I have Ben.
It's hard to bargle Noddle's house with all these marbles in my mouth.
And Kyle.
Sing distinctly. We don't wanna.
Nevermind is the second studio album by the American rock band Nirvana, released on September 24th, 1991 on DGC Records. It was produced by Butch Vig and Nirvana, and the genre is grunge, alternative rock. I'm going to read from All Music Review, Stephen Thomas Erlewine. Nevermind was never meant to change the world, but you can never predict when the zeitgeist will hit. And Nirvana's second album turned out to be the place where alternative rock crashed into the mainstream. This wasn't entirely by accident either, since Nirvana did sign with a major label and they did release a record with a shiny surface, no matter how humongous the guitars sounded. And yes, Nevermind is probably a little shinier than it should be, positively glistening with echo and fuzzbox distortion, especially when compared with the black and white murk of Bleach. This doesn't discount the record, since it's not only much harder than any mainstream rock of 1991, its character isn't on the surface. It's in the exhilarating raw music and haunting songs. It's bracing because he exercises his demons through his evocative wordplay and mangled screams, and because the band has a tremendous unbridled power that transcends the pain, turning into pure catharsis. And that's as key to the record's success as Cobain's songwriting, since Chris Novoselic and David Grohl help turn this into music that is gripping, powerful, and even fun. In retrospect, Nevermind may have seemed a little too unassuming for its mythic status. It's simply a great modern punk record, but even though it may no longer seem life-changing, it certainly is life-affirming, which may just be better. All right, what do we think of Nirvana's Nevermind?
Pretty important.
Pretty important.
Pretty damn important.
Yeah, masterpiece.
A watershed moment.
Extremely great.
Yeah.
Changed the zeitgeist. Or captured the zeitgeist. Oh my God.
Yeah, broke punk right apart.
It broke it. I went back and I rewatched the year punk broke, mm-hmm. and I remember like Thurston Moore in that video was just like, 1991 is punk's gonna happen, like it's gonna happen again. He was right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, holy shit, this record. Where do we start?
Where do we
start from the start?
I don't even know where to start. This fucker's a juggernaut.
You want to start with the opening Boston riff?
Sure.
Album opens up with
More Than a Feeling.
Smells Like Teen Spirit, which, yeah, it's kind of a bastardized More Than a Feeling riff.
I love that.
I'm going to tell you a lot of songs are More Than a Feeling, but they did bastardize it enough. And, you know, I didn't realize that Smells Like Teen Spirit was 5 minutes long.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel like five minutes long.
You're having such a good time. You don't notice.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It feels half that.
Yeah.
Absolutely bananas.
You were talking about Boston, and one of, you know, Nirvana's main influence, or one of their, the meaning, the way they wanted to write songs were make it as simple as possible. Like
songs for children.
Yeah. Make it sing-songy, make it easy to memorize, like easy to play. That was an intent.
Those boys are onto something.
Yeah. And they said it was when they started playing Smells Like Teen Spirit, they said, no, we're not playing that. That's dumb. That's a dumb riff. Like, no one wants to do that. And Cobain made them play it for like 2 hours straight. And by the end of it, they started to get it.
They came back around.
They came back around.
That's awesome.
I get what they're saying. I don't think that there's anything that Dave Grohl does on this that is simple and easy to do.
Right.
What he does is pretty straightforward, though. Like, he's
but the use of the silence and stuff, like,
yeah,
it's so
the loud, quiet, loud. Yeah.
How tight the notes are, how tight he is as a drummer is still, like, blows my mind.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, there's still a lot of digital stuff going on with his drums that was like cutting edge at the time. That yeah, they did like digital like timing and like digital reverb on his drums.
Okay,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
digital timing. Wow,
like were they were actually moving notes around?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, cool. They were punching in on a couple of the harder to track songs, and he did use a click on some of it, but.
I mean, I figured there was just a click clop click clop going yeah. in his ears the entire time. Like,
no, actually not on really? A lot of it. Yeah, he would kind of refused, but he didn't want to do that because they're such a live band. You know, they click like very
from
well.
What I read,
together.
Like
there was certain tracks, like I think like Lithium, where yep. they're really doing like the loud, quiet, louds, where a click track was necessary so the song didn't just become a runaway train by the end. You know, there's just so much momentum in that song from like the building and building that I read that was one where they definitely needed to click that one to a track.
Yeah. Something in the way because it's so slow and Kurt just played it by himself.
Okay.
And they built it around that, right?
Yeah.
He played it in the other room, like in the recording room, because it sounded better there.
Yeah.
It was hard for producer Butch Vig to convince Kurt to double track his vocals, even though it was pretty standard practice at the time. Kurt didn't think it was very cool, but...
he's not wrong.
Yeah.
So he tricked him, right?
No, he told
him that... the old John Lennon.
He said John Lennon would do it. John Lennon double tracks his vocals.
Oh, I thought he told him that he didn't quite get it a couple times to like.
He also did that. Yes. Yeah, we didn't quite get that take. Can you do that one again? And then just like,
boom.
Dub him.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
He did say that he was very good at double tracking when he doubled his vocals. He was like, Kurt would just sing it and then he would sing it again and it was almost perfect. Like, he would sing
sometimes
it the same way.
Yeah, the vocals
are
amazing.
You can tell when something's double tracked. It sounds more than thick. It sounds like two distinct vocal tracks. This album does not sound like it just sounds like one thick vocal track. You know?
And then they did the same thing for Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl does a lot of those high parts in different songs, and then they doubled him as well.
Huh.
So you just have this like harmony of these. Of a multi vocal tracks. I mean, he sang a lot on this album.
Yeah,
like a lot of the backing.
He's not lead, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing against Chad Channing. I'm very happy that Dave Grohl ended up in the same room as Kurt Cobain and Chris Novoselic. According to Dave Grohl, when he first walked into that room, he's like, "Wait, that little guy and that big guy—that's Nirvana."
Yeah, it was a. By wonderful happenstance that his band had just recently broken up because they were looking around.
Scream?
Right? Yes, Scream. They had they enlisted a couple people, including the Melvins drummer and some other drummers. And yeah, they said it clicked. What? Because they had already recorded some of this album before Dave even joined the band. But Kurt heard his vocals on, I want to say...
somewhere in Milwaukee. Like they were just touring around. They were, I think they recorded in Madison and they played a show with Tad.
Or hell something. Yeah, Tad. Yeah.
And he blew his voice out.
Yeah.
Like they had 3 or 4 days worth of recording and then he couldn't do it anymore. And then they went on a fucking like 30-day tour.
Yeah.
Cause why not?
But yeah, once it got to Dave Grohl, I mean, everything clicked and, they said it was just off after that.
Yeah.
Like they felt like a real, like a completely mm-hmm. whole group.
Like a wholly formed sound and band, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know some of these tracks actually had Chad Channing and they replaced him with Dave Grohl.
And Chad Channing's still on Something in the Way. He's just hitting a few cymbals back there, but it was easier just to leave it, you know?
So DGC, subsidiary of Sub Pop or a subsidiary that Sub Pop was somehow connected to?
Like, David Geffen.
Geffen Company.
It's a major DGC. Label, like, imprint.
I'm gonna forget that for the next 10 years, guys. I'm so sorry.
It was brought up on Goo.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
And I feel like a dingus.
Because one of the major reasons they went with it is because Sonic Youth went and Kurt looked up to Sonic Youth and it was like,
So is Bleach Sub Pop?
Yeah.
Yes.
Bleach is Sub Pop. Cool. And Kim put in a good word at DGC for Nirvana.
Yep.
Gotcha. Okay.
Amazing.
Man, I bet Touch and Go still kicking himself in the pants for turning down the Bleach.
Yeah, but you know, Sub Pop survived the whole Seattle implosion because they had points or whatever you call it or a percentage on Nevermind.
That's what I'm saying.
Because they released before contract and they had a little bit of percentage. Ooh. And guess what?
You only need a little bit.
That's all you need.
Fucking 5-1. My gameplay days are done.
Yeah, totally. Damn.
And so we're listening to Breed right now, and that is the fattest tone. It sounds like the guitar and the bass just sound like one giant instrument being played. Mm-hmm. And I think they're both just wrapped in the warmest overdriven fuzz.
Well, is it this track or a different one where Kurt Cobain like convinced Butch Vig or whoever to just like jam an output from his guitar pedal like straight into the soundboard?
I don't know what track that would be.
No, Breed is he's using a Big Muff with a bassman head and cab. So
am I thinking of Territorial Pissings?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because that one's very sharp. But this has got that Big Muff on it. So it's just got that big overdriven sound. Sounds amazing.
Sounds so good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very pub rock for this record.
Yeah.
My favorite Nirvana song is Lounge Act. How about you guys?
My favorite Nirvana song on this record is Territorial Pissing.
Really?
My favorite Nirvana song, period, would be Scentless Apprentice, I think.
That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I can't choose a baby.
I can't choose, yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, I respect that.
I can't choose. Back in the 90s, I was really into Breed and Lithium.
Sure.
Like Breed right into Lithium. And I loved the drums on In Bloom. As a guy that had just gotten a drum set, mm-hmm. In Bloom, like doo, 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 boo, 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 boo. That I just wanted to do that all day long.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah.
The drums on this album just sound so incredible.
Yeah.
Just everything.
When I was in like 6th or 7th grade and I was trying to introduce myself to the cool kids in the back of the bus, some of them of which I would later be in a band with, this one of the cool kids told me, he's like, oh, okay, well, if you want to sit with us, you have to put on my headphones. I'm going to hit play on Lithium and you need to headbang for the entire song. Even if your neck gets sore, you need
to
keep on going.
That's really cute.
And then at the end of the song, yeah, you can hang out back here.
Did you do it?
A little headbanging.
I'm just on a school bus headbanging to Lithium.
How's your neck?
It healed.
Good, yeah, okay. Awesome. Wow. It's worth it, right? Back of the bus is the coolest place in the bus.
Yeah. Oh, and we're listening to Lithium right now, so it's bringing back all those memories.
They said, too, Lithium is like one of the songs that everyone would dance to in the clubs. It's like more upbeat than some of the songs. It's not as...
It's got some melodicness.
You get a little cool down and then you get to... Mm-hmm. Freak out,
man! And then that it's got that cool like walking bass line in the middle eight, like during the bridge.
It's unpredictable and kind of scary. It's like
it's cool. It's really cool.
What are you doing?
This album just reminds me of not knowing what the lyrics are and trying to sing along and getting every fucking lyric wrong. Like. Still cold sweats go down my back.
See, I like that. I feel like it lets you kind of play with what you want the words to be. And then you have all these two-tone meanings to stuff because it's like what it sounds like to you and then what it actually is saying. So
that was, yeah, I thought it was so genius. I mean, when I first heard this, I was like, hello, hello, hello. And then I was like, hello, how, wait, what's he saying? And then I just like realized he was like morphing the lyrics into
about the sound.
Yeah, more. It's about the sound and things like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of the lyrics, do you guys know how Smells Like Teen Spirit got its name?
Please tell that story, Anne.
It's the best story of all time. Actually, we listened great. To Kathleen Hanna like tell it today because she's a fantastic storyteller.
Yeah.
I recommend that you look it up. But basically, she was on a bender with Kurt Cobain, and she got so drunk that at one point she was writing shit on his walls with Sharpie marker. And I guess she wrote Kurt Cobain Smells Like Teen Spirit. She woke up and she was hungover and she had like yelled at so many people that it was like one of those drunks you don't ever want to remember again. So he asked her later, like, can I use what you wrote on my wall? She's like, sure, whatever. Because she didn't want to think about the bender, right? And then it just came up everywhere. So,
but we know what Teen Spirit was, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
I wore Teen Spirit, the rose flavor, as a kid. It's a type of deodorant for teens. I mean, it or smells, like I guess, you know. A scent and smell are similar.
So, at the time, Kurt Cobain was... He was dating Toby Vail, the drummer. Drummer for Bikini Kill. And Toby and Kathleen wore Teen Spirit deodorant. Kurt Cobain didn't know what Teen Spirit deodorant was. So when Kathleen writes it across his wall, basically like, you smell like your girlfriend's armpits, you know, Kurt Cobain sees it not knowing that it's a brand name.
He's like, anarchy.
He interprets it as some kind of like revolutionary slogan.
Yeah.
He's like, yes.
Yeah, it's especially sweet that he does not know what it means, right?
That's
great.
It's so sweet.
That really brings it into the like video too, because it's at the high school pep rally. I mean...
Well, it feels like that teen marketed deodorant was maybe something that started in the 90s, too, right?
I
like,
swear.
The teen demographic was like something marketed.
Samuel Bayer, that's the director, right?
Yep. Yeah, the video just, I mean, that just drove this album into the stratosphere, too. They just started, they played it on 120 minutes, and then it just was on constantly.
Cheerleaders.
Yeah, I know I say masterpiece and iconic a lot, but like...
the right context.
This shit was everywhere, constantly, all the time. Nirvana was like, Nirvana and Pearl Jam were like MTV's favorite bands for a couple of years. And
yeah.
That's,
100%.
Yeah.
The video, going back to that, what he wanted to do was more of like a kitschy rock and roll high school where they like tied up the principal and put a dunce cap on him. And Kurt was like, no, we're not doing this like this other.
It's been done.
This is like so silly and that is not right for this song. So he like recut it and he cut in the weird like teachers and it was just like the party. It just looked like the greatest gig.
I think the director of that video did like the Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Oh no!
I think right, like it's unwatchable and horrible.
It's fucking unwatchable for sure. I do not recommend anybody watch that movie.
So bad.
I don't know about y'all, but the most iconic person in that music video is the janitor with the mop bucket.
Yep,
dancing along. That image has stuck with me for so long.
You should be that for Halloween one year.
Oh, yes, the janitor from the Smells Like Teen Spirit pep rally.
Wow, deep cut.
I mean...
And, like, while I'm at your party, I can just clean the floors.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful to me.
Everyone will slip and fall down.
Yeah. I did want to say something more about the lyrics. Grohl has stated that he does not believe that the song Smells Like Teen Spirit has any message. He says, just seeing Kurt write the lyrics to a song 5 minutes before he first sings them, you just kind of find it a little bit hard to believe that the song has a lot to say about something. You need symbols to fill up the space or you need something that rhymes.
I get that. But yeah, he said that when, like, right after Kurt Cobain died, like, Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl sued, I think, for like credits on that song.
Mm-hmm.
Like no it. Other songs off that album, but that song, they were like, yeah, we co-wrote that, you know. It just so happens to be the biggest Nirvana song, but
yeah, should have been the one that's
I mean, I believe right them, now. I guess, but I'm sure that
I mean, I think that they can be unplanned without losing all meaning. Like, I think sure. that's like a really hard line to draw.
Sure.
Because there's so much raw emotion going on in the vocalizing of what's happening that like there's still meaning to it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The one part of this album that I don't think has aged as well as the rest of the album is the intro to Territorial Pissings.
Really? That's hilarious.
It's just so like 90s edgy.
But I feel like this sets the mold for a lot of that. And it's not like
that's pissing on your parents' favorite song.
Yep.
Yeah. Sure. Sure. I mean, it's hard to pick at anything on this album, but it's if like, I had to pick something, it's just a little intro to that song.
Fuck you, boomers.
Dad.
Right?
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it
gets me hype.
What is it? Probably the most
I love the guitar tone, too.
Yeah, this is the most punk one.
Yeah.
This is the most punk thing that I had ever heard.
Yeah.
I didn't know that that's what it was called.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. I mean, this is probably...
This is like the closest to the Wipers, I feel like, they ever got.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also thought it was like really cool. It doesn't get brought up enough, but obviously this made, you know, all those other bands, Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue, all that kind of overnight was just kind of like done with, right? Like this ushered in an era
instantly
of mm-hmm. MTV that captured people's
uncool
ideas.
This was the moment they started not showing enough Z-nuff. Poison.
But I want to say, going along with that, which I hadn't really conceptualized until this week, is that he made it okay to have anthems that were not derogatory towards women.
Yeah.
That were
absolutely
someone who's bearing their own emotions and being like vulnerable, and it wasn't perceived as like this like a quote unquote kind of like wussy thing to do, right? It wasn't perceived as like someone, you know.
Well, yeah,
was a singer-songwriter, yeah. But it was like
wrap it up in this fucking like cacophony of
right.
like, you know, guitars and fucking noise and energy. Of course not, you know. But yeah, put on an acoustic guitar and like do Nirvana's Unplugged set before this comes out, and absolutely not ever. You know?
Yeah.
Like I don't know.
I'm not dissing it.
I'm just saying that the strength of this music might have had an audience either way. I think the fact that it's noisy electric guitar stuff is like a bigger audience, but right. like, well, I don't know that it wouldn't have ever gone anywhere. I think that's like,
I don't think it would have ever hit the majestic peaks for the Tragic Fall.
I don't know.
Rob, can I pick up on this?
I would love you to.
In middle school, like I remember like when Nirvana hit, it was huge, you know. I remember right before this record came out, like being homophobic was super cool. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that we're all in Indiana. In middle school, if you were gay, you got your ass kicked. When this record came out in middle school, like soft, you know, sensitive dudes were bullied into oblivion. And this record came out. And that was the first time that, you know, Kurt Cobain was like, it's not cool to bully dudes. It's okay to be gay. You know, and he wore dresses and he rocked out. And I feel like I listened to him as a young impressionable dude at the age of 12, you know, and I feel like he changed a lot of minds. And I feel like that was an important thing to do after, you know, the 80s and, you know, like the macho rocker image and the, you know, preying upon the weak. So that's always something that I took from Nirvana, you know, like just 30 years later, like thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I wanted to bring up, I guess.
You know that Kurt and Chris were in a CCR tribute band called the Sellouts before Nirvana?
Aww. Oh,
jeez.
I love it.
Do you have any links?
No, I wish.
Cobain described Nirvana as the Knacked and the Bay City Rollers getting molested by Black Flag and Black Sabbath.
I like that.
That's a pretty good one. To go back to also about the electric guitars, he wanted, since the songs were so, he knew the songs were melodic. I mean, he writes catchy songs, right? And so he wanted those guitars to sound as big as possible, like crunchy, big guitars, heavy drums, because he knew if it wasn't, it wouldn't sound the way he wanted it to sound. Mm-hmm. He knew that it would sound like a pop album, and it would. I mean, if it didn't have those huge guitars, it would just be a pop album.
For sure. No, I could see this record like coming up this exact year and just sounding horrible, you know.
Speaking of pop album, this is this Smells Like Teen Spirit and Moulin Rouge got me to walk out of that movie.
What? Oh,
you
no,
hate was Moulin it the Rouge.
Yeah.
Was it wait,
don't,
what?
Don't like that Baz Luhrmann?
That was
hey,
the
what? What's happening? I love Moulin Rouge.
He's nope. dissing on it.
It was
wait, the, are you too, Anne?
No, I don't care.
It was the final straw. I was just like, no.
It
kind of
sucks.
I'm not going here.
I don't love when it, they but did like, the, I'm not going to walk
Smells Like
out
Teen
of it.
Spirit can.
Right. I got to that area, and then I was just like, this is just, no, I'm not getting it.
Have you tried to watch it in the past 20 years?
Oh, I've watched it since then, but just like when I sat down, I was like, no.
Get out of here, Buzz.
Get out of here.
I'm going to go watch Fight Club instead.
Yes, Snowflake. Yes, Space Monkey.
Oh, man.
Cobain played 1960s Fender Mustang, Fender Jaguar with Dia Maras pickups, and a Fender Stratocaster with humbucker bridge pickups. Used distortion and chorus pedals as his main effects. To get that watery sound, he would use a small clone. Come As You Are in the pre-chorus of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And then they
were
all tuned
60s
down.
60s Fenders cheap
yes.
in that's Seattle what, in the 90s?
Yep. That's what Sonic Youth picked up on. They all had these, they were Japanese imports from the 90s.
Wait, from the 90s? You said he played a 60s Mustang.
That's a 60s Fender Mustangs, but...
In the 90s, they were Japanese imports from
yeah,
the
60s.
Yeah. But...
So he's playing a Japanese...
No, I'm
60s
sorry.
60s Japanese
no.
Mustang?
No, sorry. I just confused you. He's playing a 60s Fender Mustang, and Fender Jaguars and Jazzmasters were pretty cheap around that time. That's
wild.
Yeah.
But they're not from Japan.
In the 90s, they remade because of the explosion of grunge.
Yes,
they reissued.
They
them.
Reissued from Japan Mustangs, Jazzmasters, and Jaguars.
Okay,
and
even those now are quite expensive. Like 90s Japanese Jaguars,
yes.
Or like man, let alone shit, a 64 USA Mustang. That's like a $6,000 guitar. That's cool.
And they broke them all the time.
And they broke
all
them
all the time.
That's because it's cool, guys. Don't you understand what's cool? Breaking shit.
Well, honestly, though, you don't you break the neck. You don't break the.
It just broke them.
Yeah, but like the pickups and stuff stay pretty
you think
much
they
intact.
Were carefully
when you did that.
Fixing them after every show.
I know that Sonic Youth was.
I think it's easier to replace broken pickups than a broken neck, Rob.
I don't play those instruments, and I don't care.
I don't think so.
Rude. Yeah.
I don't know. I thought necks would be cheaper than the fancy
I think
old
that's the
school.
Whole, the bend of it is important, right?
Yeah.
What truss rods? Is that what it's called?
Yes, truss rods.
And frets.
What is this aftertouch?
Give you a quiz where you have to fill it in.
Yeah.
Speaking of guitar gear, the first time I ever stepped on a chorus pedal to see what it sounded like, I stepped on a chorus pedal, didn't know what it did. I knew it was called chorus, but I'm like, yeah, but a distortion. I know it makes it crunchy. Chorus, what does it do? So I stepped on it. I played one note, just an open E. I'm like, oh shit, that's the Nirvana pedal. It's just Come As You Are.
Yep.
You know, like, chorus with no distortion is Nirvana's slower jams, and then chorus with distortion is the heavier parts. I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but man, you can cheat a Nirvana sound.
Not really. I mean, almost any chorus pedal, you can probably get a Nirvana tone. Very effective, though.
So
I'll say.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Birch. What chorus is doing is it's taking the tone you're playing, and it's also playing something that's just slightly out of tune to it. So it's not enough out of tune that it sounds wrong, but it's enough out of tune that it just sounds a little warbly. It sounds thicker and a little bit warblier.
Yeah, it's like a chorus. It's creating that
it's a chorus, but of slight imperfection. So
it's, yes. That's so what chorus means, because people can't sing exactly the same, right?
That's true. That's true. Yeah. As opposed to just duplicating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's cool. Yeah. Like, that's just turn the chorus all the way up, play some open notes, and that's Come As You Are.
It debuted on Billboard 200 at number 144.
And that was September of 91. When did it hit number one?
How long did it take?
About January, probably.
It was January. It knocked Michael Jackson. January 11th, 1992, replacing Michael Jackson's Dangerous,
yeah,
at the top of the Billboard chart, which was a huge deal for just an unknown band.
Oh, of course.
From Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about it, they formed in, 87? It's like, this is how long it took for this to happen, right? It's like fucking unbelievable.
It's so great.
It's real wild.
Can I read you a little thing from Kreisgau?
Please do.
All right. After years of hair-flailing sludge that achieved occasional song form on singles no normal person ever heard, Seattle finally produces some proper post-punk, aptly described by resident genius Kurt Cobain, quote, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, solo, bad solo, unquote. This is hard rock as the term was understood before metal moved in. The kind of loud, slovenly, tuneful music you think no one will ever work a change on again until the next time it happens, whereupon you wonder why there isn't loads more. It seems so simple. A.
Hell yeah. And
also I love won, that Kreisgau review. I like a lot of his reviews.
It really won Paz and Jop's number one album of 91.
Fucking good, yeah.
Of course.
It changed everything. So good.
I can't even describe how much it changed.
It's yeah.
I was thinking about this week.
Did you get into this like when it came out?
It was one of the first CDs I've ever bought.
Okay.
I would have been 12.
All right. Yeah, I didn't. I bought Weird Al's Off the Deep End before I bought this record.
Of course. So Weird Al brought me here.
1992, for my birthday, my mom let me buy some CDs, and I got Criss Cross's maxi single for Jump Jump, and then I got Weird Al's Off the Deep End. And from there, I got into Nirvana. I was one of the Weird Al bump. Once that album came out, Nevermind shipped another million records.
Oh, my God.
I was on that same train.
So for everyone who doesn't know, at the top of the hour or whatever, y'all all said lyrics from the Weird Al version of Smells Like Teen Spirit, right?
Did we?
Yeah.
Listen, so I haven't actually ever heard that version that I know of.
Interesting.
Oh, really?
I mean, maybe, man, I've heard it on the radio, but yeah.
Weird Al made me a Nirvana fan.
Yeah,
for sure. Too.
That's cool, man.
Kyle, you were a Nirvana fan from the jump, right?
It's a little hazy, to be honest.
Okay.
What is the release date of Smells Like Nirvana? Does anybody have the street date of that single?
September something, 91.
Well, Smells Like Nirvana would be
Smells Like
was
Nirvana.
92. It was it
must 92?
If I bought it for my birthday,
April 3rd, 92.
Okay, so yeah. June 11th, 1992, like Jurassic Park debuted.
I forgot he was swimming after a donut.
You know, I know all about that that summer. But real talk, I head off the deep end before I had. Never mind.
Okay, cool. Cool. Hey, that makes three of us. Birch is the only OG.
I'm a little ashamed.
Hey, man,
I have a big brother.
You didn't ask me if I was listening to it when I was six.
I didn't have a big brother. All I had
when I heard it, it definitely changed everything for me, even though it was much later, right? Yeah.
All right, cool. I'm sorry for leaving you out of that. Just
saying. I certainly did not have a Weird Al. Not out of hatred, just out of lack of interest.
Out of hatred. Fair enough. In our days, 'cause I found God.
So Something in the Way is on right now.
That's so beautiful.
What was the secret track on this album?
Endless Nameless.
And it didn't get put onto the first batch
50,000 albums.
Yeah.
It says, I read that some people traded in their batch, their first pressing that didn't have it, to get the one with the extra track.
What?
So they like had this very valuable pressing.
No, and just, they're like, oh, but I wanted this song. Just
buy them. That hurts my heart.
I'm with you, Ben, but you know,
hurts
like.
My fucking heart.
You just don't know it's going to go strat, you know.
If you've got a first edition of anything and there's a flaw on it.
Oh, true.
And
you buy the fucking second edition, you have
again,
two.
Then you have two.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and Something in the Way is like one of my favorite
Nirvana
songs for
it's
sure.
It's my favorite.
Batman brought me here.
It's just hard.
Oh, I was going to say the new Batman.
That's when that first started, right? I read that too.
Robert Pattinson's being a sad Batman listening to Nirvana.
But I definitely liked it before that. Robert Pattinson did not turn me on to Nirvana.
No one knows what it's like to be the Batman.
To be the Batman.
The sad
Batman. Behind this cowl.
But it's kind of, I don't know, it's interesting because that speaks to how the music industry works now, right?
Yeah.
In a lot of
ways. And I want to get away from talking about soundtracks because that's what I do. It's like soundtracks that came out within 3 years in the early 90s. And
well, the Batman one came out in 2020.
Now this isn't a goddamn Batman movie.
Yeah. Well,
I think the Penguin looks sad to it at some point.
So this. During this song, they tried different instrumentations. Kurt wasn't very happy, as Anne had mentioned earlier. They recorded it in the sound booth. What I found really interesting, though, is Butch Vig was like, just sing it how you want to sing it. Like, I'll figure it out. Just do what you do. I'll figure out how to record it. And he was barely just singing, like, just the softest, like, singing you could possibly get.
Vig was like, turn off all of the air conditioning.
Yeah, that's right.
Turn off everything.
Take off the phone. He's just like lying on the couch.
Like Birch before the podcast.
Yeah. But I love that. You can just hear that come across. And they kept telling
give it your most desperate, breathiest take.
Yeah. Dave Grohl just like, keep, no, quieter, quieter, quieter. And then he brought in a cello and.
Yeah.
Good work on that.
That sounds so good.
Yeah.
So beautiful.
And it's commonly believed that Something in the Way is a period when Cobain was homeless and slept underneath the Yonge Street Bridge.
He said he did not sleep under that bridge.
Yeah, in Aberdeen.
And he didn't. When he was homeless, he mostly slept in a refrigerator box on someone's porch.
On
or
the Melvin's.
One of the Melvin's porch. Or he would go to apartment buildings and like be in the hallways, or he'd go to the hospital. And be there.
Yeah.
So it's
I remember reading their book in high school, and Kurt Cobain talked about how like he could live for eating on 99 cents a day by buying these 3 packs of corn dogs. You get 3 corn dogs, it's 99 cents. He lived off of corn dogs. I think that's what Something in the Way is about.
I mean, he said it was about him imagining like dying of AIDS and being like homeless and like really hopeless.
That's what's going to happen if you eat nothing but corn dogs 3 meals a
you'll
day.
You'll get AIDS.
Uh-oh.
No, but you'll have terrifying dreams. Of.
Nobody will want you to live in their home. Is that what you mean?
No, that's not what I mean.
I don't understand what you mean, man. It's okay.
I think 3 corn dogs a day will eventually kill you.
Well, you need a squeeze of citrus in there.
What a way to go, though.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah, a little lemon juice on a corn dog. Damn. You got me hungry.
So you don't get scurvy.
That's right.
Did anyone ever like go to high school and there was like some dudes who dressed up like Kurt Cobain?
That was like the majority of people that
have
I knew.
Have you ever been to any high school?
In like 95.
Kyle, I've seen your pictures. I've seen the school photos from 1994 and 95.
Yeah.
You had the most luxurious Cobain locks
I've
ever seen.
I am a founding member of the Kurtz in high school.
That's why you asked about it. Do you have a secret code, like shake handshake?
With other Kurtz?
Yeah.
Yeah. We tug each other's hair.
When I showed up the first day to seventh grade in 1994, I think every boy my age had like chin length hair and a flannel and holes in their jeans.
And a little beard.
And a little beard.
Amazing. racing.
And a heroin addiction.
A crippling heroin addiction.
Well, so, like, his substance abuse stuff, part of that was out of, like, chronic pain.
Right.
Like, he had really serious chronic pain in his stomach. Pain. He, like, couldn't eat. And then he also had, like, chronic bronchitis type stuff. So, and nobody could treat it. He tried and tried. Even, like, once he, like, had all that money, he still tried to, like, figure out how to treat. And they just couldn't. Nobody could help him.
Or dude.
When Kurt Cobain like first started making money, the first thing he ever bought for himself was a fucking Centipede arcade machine.
Do you find that relatable, Kyle?
No, I'm not joking at all. That's why.
Is that why it's playing in the background?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That was the first thing he ever bought for himself. Like, as I'm a rich, you know, superstar.
He'll take no more of my quarters.
I'm going to have a Centipede machine in my room.
It's a money saver.
Yeah.
When you think about
right.
it.
That's right.
It pays for itself.
And he got first place and he wrote poo.
You have to get first place on your own game.
So we're getting two more of these records.
Yes.
Indiduro and then the Unplugged.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. That's correct.
Cool.
This has sold more than 30 million copies, making it one of the best selling albums of all time. Certified Diamond 1999.
Fucking insane, dude.
So, yeah.
Did we cover Bleach on some week that I missed, or did we not cover Bleach?
Bleach isn't in there.
Okay. But still, three out of the four. Okay, so they released three studio albums, two of which we're covering. Then Incesticide was
B-sides.
It's like a comp thing, yeah.
And then the acoustic live album, which we have too. That's that's a good showing.
The Unplugged.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crucial music.
It is must hear before you die. Must. Mm-hmm.
It sounds fresh to me. I don't know if it would sound fresh to someone who had never heard it.
I bet it would.
I think you could get there.
I guess I need to be like niece, nephew.
Don't force kids these days wear Nirvana shirts.
These Seinfeld loving Zoomers, they gotta love this, right?
People still respond like to Led the Beatles, Zeppelin,
right?
And that has nothing to do with the age of the music. It has to do with the melodicism and. Kurt Cobain knew that music comes first, lyrics can come second or not at all.
He's writing music for toddlers.
He's writing these songs and they're very melodic and they make perfect pop sense. The way we're talking about like music when we're talking about Weezer and things like that is it's pop. It's like pop gems and you just know when you hear it.
Right.
Like something sounds really good and your brain is going to like respond to that.
Okay.
So,
all right, but which song is Nirvana ripping off with "Come as You Are"? It's a Pixies song.
Oh
right?
no, it's not. Pixies.
Killing Joke,
Killing Joke, 80s, and also The Damned, Life Goes On.
Yeah,
all three of those songs share basically that same riff.
Yeah,
Nirvana's came third chronologically.
I mean, it is a very when you write simple songs, you're going to be stepping on toes.
I wasn't joking earlier when I said hit some open notes. You know, like. You can accidentally play "Come as You Are."
Yeah,
it's that simple of a melody.
It's
on a
the
guitar.
Chorus pedal involved in it that gave Killing Joke like the we won the lawsuit.
Yes,
like,
yeah, and they actually dropped the lawsuit after it because he had died, and they were like, I think they thought that was in bad taste.
Okay,
but they were kind of angry because they were like, yeah, this is our song, like. It sounds exactly the same, which it does. And then
it's really, really similar.
They were also angry because they were like Nirvana or their lawyers or whoever said they had never heard of Killing Joke, but Nirvana had sent them a Christmas card.
Boys are too nice for their own good. See,
I know. Some people have speculated that, "Come as You Are" is about heroin addiction. One thing I found interesting is the lyrics, "Come doused in mud, soaked in bleach, speak directly to Seattle's area HIV prevention campaign from the time period, encouraging addicts to sterilize their needles with bleach before using them," with the tagline, "If doused in mud, soak it in bleach, and as a friend, as a trend, as a known enemy." For some, it was a further allegory of addiction to the drug. I had no clue.
Itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
It's just kind of like automatic writing. Like,
yeah,
sometimes it makes sense, you know, because it comes
right
from
what you
place.
See. Yeah.
I did find it interesting, though, on Polly, it was recorded featuring Cobain playing a 5-string Stella guitar. I'm very familiar with Stella guitars that he purchased from a pawn shop for $20. He did not
Stella
bother.
Stella guitars from pawn shops are the best.
Yes, Ben has one. He didn't bother changing the strings, so he said it barely stays in tune. In fact, they had to duct tape and hold the tuning keys in place. And it's just like, the tone is just a plunky, like,
was guitar. New Wave Polly, did that come first? And then
no, that was after
the stripped down version. Okay,
no, because that was on Incesticide.
Yeah, but who played on that? Was that Grohl? I mean, if it's not Grohl, then it's gotta be
in my brain. New Wave Polly came first. That's how they played it, and then they stripped it down. But
again, yeah,
they said that it didn't, though.
Okay, well, then
they said they created that.
Oh,
later.
Yeah,
yeah,
call me wrong,
calling me wrong. See you.
Where do you get off, Birch?
Call all you wrong. Boston Globe counter argument. We need someone. Boston Globe was less enthusiastic. Steve Morris wrote, quote, "Most of Nirvana is packed with generic pop punk that has been done by countless acts from Iggy Pop to Red Hot Chili Peppers," and then added, "The band has little or nothing to say, settling for moronic ramblings by singer lyricist Cobain."
Man, if he wants some pop punk, just wait.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's going to have a really great time later.
Oh, you're kidding. You can have your share of pop punk later
Ben,
on this
if
decade.
He wants some moronic pop punk, just
oh,
wait.
Oh, man. Oh.
Oh, man. It's coming down that pipe. Woo!
Oh. Does anybody want to go around the room? Or I am assuming everyone's on the...
It's fucking great.
Yeah, it's
never mind.
The most important records that was ever put out.
I think so, yeah.
Humans.
I'm going to stop you right there. This is one of the most important records ever put out of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so, too. I was thinking about this week, and I think if there were... This is probably the most important record of my life.
Oh, for sure.
Like, yeah. It set me in a direction that I probably would have gotten there with another record, but this was the one that set me on the path. Now, is it my favorite record? No, but it is probably in my lifetime. It like changed. Like what I'm trying to say is the direction of my life changed when this album came out.
100%.
Birch, I feel like I'm feeling you because
yeah.
I can draw a direct line from Nirvana to Jesus Lizard.
Right.
You know, to Brainiac.
Well, and even not hearing it at the time, like hearing this at an age where it hit with me, like changed what I sought out and like changed the direction of like the music that I knew was possible and like what I liked, right?
Yeah.
And it was so broadly out there. Everybody has heard like this album, if not entirely, like tons of it on the radio, right?
Yeah.
And it just like, it shifts everything.
I mean, I was 12 at the time, came out, got a guitar. I learned all these songs and they're very easy songs to learn.
So you felt super cool.
Power chords.
So yeah, power chords. I learned all, the, you know, he doesn't do a bunch of flashy solos. And so like everything just like locked into place. And I was like, well, I'm playing guitar now. And Nirvana is like the band. And like this is just happening. And then, yeah. And then I got into all sorts of other bands that were right next to it. So.
Yeah, it tangentially important to me just because all of the bands that I got into after this band broke and like, you know, again, I didn't get this album until after it initially came out. But yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. Like someone was going to be Nirvana. The zeitgeist was going to happen. And it just happened to have happened with this band. And, you know, so that the same way the Beatles, someone was going to be the Beatles eventually.
Sure,
and, so this is the one that we have. And it changed the rock and roll post-punk landscape forever. And it's important. So, yeah.
And it's a good album.
It's a great album.
Yeah.
It's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does not tire the ears. At least these old ears of mine.
This was definitely one of the first records that I heard that I was like, I could kind of do this, you know, like,
yeah,
This is, I mean, just like, you know, in the late 70s with the Ramones. This is like, you know, after listening to all the, you know, 80s virtuoso guitar glam gods, there's just some dude in a sweater, you know, playing power chords. You could probably do that if you... This put like the power back in the hands of the, I don't know, of the fans.
It did. Absolutely. All right. Next time we'll be talking about Crowded House, Woodface. Thanks, Woodface.
Thanks, Woodface.